Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 19, and it's the third week of October 1942. The Germans have launched a major offensive on October 14th in an attempt to take the tractor works and Barakardi plant with a view to finally driving the Red Army across the Volga River. A terrible battle has been waged inside the Red October plant, the tractor factory, and the Barakardi plant. The carnage inside has become part of the mystique of Stalingrad, where men were fighting for each workshop and canteen, each small room, each bombed-out building. It was worse than hand-to-hand. It was tooth and nail. In some cases, literally, as men tore at each other with blunt instruments like bits of rebar, chunks of rubble, and even their teeth. At the three main factories north of Mamayev Hill, the Germans threw themselves into the fight day after day, trying to crush the Russians. By October 20th, they had seized all the tractor plant shops and broken into the mammoth breastworks of the Barakardi. Further south, they had also occupied the western end of the Red October plant. General Choikov, who had commanded the Russian 62nd Army, moved his headquarters on the 17th of October, 3 days after the start of the major offensive ordered by Adolf Hitler. As we heard last episode, that was fortunate for Choikov because his former trench cum bunker was overrun by the Germans. Choikov ended up in his new HQ on the riverbank level with Mamayev Kurgan. He would remain there until the relief of the city the following year. Despite the fact that General Paulus had seen his forces bolstered by specialist units of engineers and police battalions experienced in street fighting, the Russians remained the masters of fighting inside buildings, room by room. They had developed killing zones around houses and squares, which were heavily mined and covered by intersecting machine gun crossfire. Choikov was a specialist himself and described some of the techniques. "Experience taught us," he said. "Get close to the enemy's positions. Move on all fours, making use of craters and ruins. Dig your trenches by night. Camouflage them by day. Make your build-up for the attack stealthy, without any noise. Carry your Tommy gun on your shoulder. Take 10 to 12 grenades. Timing and purpose will then be on your side. Two of you get into the house together," Choikov continued in his memoirs. "Be lightly dressed without a knapsack and the grenade bare. Go in grenade first, you go after. The whole house. Again, always, grenade first, you after. Each corner of the room must be taken, for an enemy soldier could be lurking behind rubble or broken furniture. A grenade in each corner. Then the Tommy gun sprays what's left. Move on." Then there was also the use of the dagger and the sharpened spade I mentioned 2 episodes ago. The terrifyingly effective Stalingrad spade, which was sharpened to raise a consistency on one side and used like an axe. But still the Germans pushed forward through these great buildings now covered in blood. They were suffering mentally as these dark, smoky, terrifyingly internal fights were hand to hand. "God, why have you forsaken us?" wrote a lieutenant of the 24th Panzer Division. "We have fought during 15 days for a single house with mortars, grenades, machine guns and bayonets. Already, by the third day, 54 German corpses are strewn in the cellars, on the landings and the staircases." Casualties were mounting. "There is a ceaseless struggle from noon to night." The men's faces were pitch black from the soot and dirt, sometimes etched by flows of sweat. "We bombard each other with grenades in the middle of explosions, clouds of dust and smoke, heaps of mortar, floods of blood, fragments of furniture and human beings. Ask any soldier what half an hour of hand-to-hand struggle means in such a fight." Then you should imagine Stalingrad. 80 days and 80 nights they had been fighting. The streets were nothing. It was not measured in meters or feet, but in corpses. Stalingrad was no longer a city. It was an enormous cloud of smoke, a furnace lit by flames and flickering like an evil eye at night. Adam Clark, in his book Barbarossa, continues the description penned by the 14th Panzer Division lieutenant. "And when the night arrives, one of those scorching, howling, bleeding nights, the dogs plunge into the Volga and swim desperately to gain the other bank. The nights of Stalingrad are a terror for them. Animals flee this hell. The hardest stones cannot bear it for long. Only men endure." By October 24th, the assault ordered by Hitler had fizzled out. The Germans were exhausted. It was also on that day that Lieutenant Wilhelm Kreiser of the 100th Division celebrated his 26th birthday. He was sitting on a chair in a Stalingrad house when a Russian tank fired a shell that passed right between his legs and onto the next room. Unhurt, Kreiser laid low for the day. The following morning, Kreiser and his men attacked the Barricade plant, where the main line of resistance was along a railway embankment. Kreiser directed his platoons into the jumping-off sections and waited for the Stukas to prepare the way. When they arrived, their bombs fell only 200 yards ahead of where Kreiser and his men lay. Then Kreiser fired flares several times to stop Stuka pilots from bombing their own men. It was a pinpoint attack, and yet it failed. The Russians held on. The Germans had dinner and then relaunched their attack at 10 that night. Thousands of German guns laid down an immense bombardment on the Russian positions. When it stopped, there was silence. Even the constant shooting had stopped. German soldiers jumped up and ran across the railway tracks, finally reaching the cliff face overlooking the Volga at that point. Lieutenant Kreiser thought to himself that it was it. The war was over. A bad miscalculation. The Russians had burrowed into their cellars and holes and waited for the incredible barrage to end. The Germans then ran past these positions, believing the Russians were all dead or had run away. Now the Red Army was behind many German companies and groups who prepared for a counterattack on the bank of the Volga. They were looking the wrong way. Kreiser believed reinforcements were imminent and ordered his men to dig in at a small schoolhouse nearby. That night, though, was one of horror for the Germans. Using Choikov and Pavlov's techniques, the Russians crawled towards the schoolhouse silently as the terrified 100th Division fired at the shadowy figures that loomed suddenly towards them in the dark. Only a few Germans lived to tell the tale of what happened as they managed to drag themselves back to their own lines. One German commander told his men that, "The dogs are fighting like lions!" The front had now frozen with neither side capable of fighting any further. German casualties, as I mentioned earlier, were running at around 60% on average, and no army can sustain these sorts of losses, particularly if they're fighting a long battle like Stalingrad. Their cries of "Seine" and "Hilfe" from German wounded could be heard across the city and became as much the sound of Stalingrad as gunfire and explosions, the sounds of ricochets off concrete. Yet the Russian 62nd Army was now reduced to a few bridgeheads on the west bank of the Volga, none more than a few hundred yards deep. The Barricade plant had been partially overrun by the Germans, and soon the 62nd's last crossing point would come under direct fire. Some ferries would dock with only one man alive. One slowly nudged the landing, and every single man on board had been machine gunned to death. All reinforcements were then sent into that sector to save the landing point. Had it fallen, the city would be lost. Soviet divisions now, though, were reduced to a few hundred men. The most crucial day for this crossing came on the 26th of October 1942, where the Russians' last lifeline to the far bank of the Volga, the 62nd Crossing, as it was known, came under this sustained fire. The Germans, advancing from the Barricade into the Red October factory, were just 400 meters away. Seeing this, their soldiers burst out cheering. With this last river crossing out of action, they were convinced the 62nd Army would be unable to hold out any longer. The battle would be over. Instead, it spurred the defenders to a final extraordinary effort. When we lost the 62nd crossing, and neither the ferry nor the pontoon bridge could be used, it represented the supreme supply crisis for our army, said Anatoly Mareshko, who was Choikov's staff officer. The Germans did not believe we could keep going any longer, but each of our divisions now organized its own crossing group, and these brave men, supplied with small boats, made the hazardous journey across the river two or three times a night to bring in food and ammunition. It was these small boats that kept the Russian bridgeheads going. The Luftwaffe was trying to destroy these boats, but by the day, the Russians hid them, including burying them under the sand of the Volga banks. "At night, we dug them out again," said Mareshko. The Red Army's position looked desperate, but the defenders were determined to hang on. Teenagers, adopted by the army as sons of the regiment, were even swimming the river, pushing across small rafts of supplies. This is the stuff of legend. Ludnikov's 138th Division was holding the section behind the factory, running down towards the Volga. Gortiev's 308th Division occupied the workers' settlement and the factory building. They were now bearing the brunt of the German assault. The Germans had assembled a mighty arsenal to devastate the small area. flame-throwing tanks, six-barreled mortars, armadas of dive bombers, splinter bombs, thermite shells. They worked on a simple principle. It would not be possible for human beings to stand the strain of such an onslaught. And yet, they miscalculated how effective the Russian defensive positions were. As Chuikov rightly said, if cowardice is contagious, so is courage. The remarkable resilience of Radimtsev's 13th Guards, pressed back towards the Volga embankment, and Zolidev's 37th in the tractor factory, was becoming a mass phenomenon. The Germans still believed that when a division could no longer maintain its communications and its units were isolated and surrounded, it would lose its will to resist. This has been proven true in battle many times, but it was no longer true in Stalingrad. Paulus was following the standard playbook: capture the major strategic objective and the enemy wilts. Following their planned capture of the Barikadi, the Germans intended to strike at the junction point of Smekotvorov's and Ludnikov's divisions and to infiltrate the Russian defense line. But the Russians surged forward, recaptured three factory workshops from the enemy, advanced about a kilometer, and completely disrupted the momentum of the German assault. And the picture of who was more motivated had changed. Every morning, starting in late October, Russians shaved. As one officer in the Red Army said, "All of us have observed one very odd difference between ourselves and the Germans. Nearly every morning we shave. The Germans are all unshaved and untidy. In our dugouts we have odd pieces of soft furniture, bunks, and even the occasional musical instrument. Hot food is carried to the front line, usually 200 or 300 meters away, and every week, no matter how heavy the fighting, every soldier goes to the bathhouse and also gets a set of clean underwear. But the Germans, they don't wash. They don't shave. It makes a big difference." Living quarters were taken very seriously in Stalingrad. Vasily Grossman observed the banter that accompanied it. "There was probably nowhere in the world where the construction of living quarters was taken more seriously than in Stalingrad. When you were talking about someone, you always mentioned the quality of his bunker. Batyuk's doing some fine work on Mamiev Kurgan with his mortars. He's got a fine bunker, by the way. A huge oak door, just like the Senate building. Yes, he's certainly got a head on his shoulders." While of another man it might be said, "Well, what do you know? He was forced to retreat during the night. He had no liaison with his units and he lost a key position. As for his command post, it was visible from the air. And he had a soldier's cape by way of a door to keep out the flies, I suppose. An empty-headed fellow. I heard his wife left him before the war." Rituals became part of the 62nd Army's way of life. The most important was the oath not to surrender Stalingrad, with its indomitable slogan, "There is no land for us beyond the Volga." From 17 October 1942, new recruits swore this oath on reaching the small strip of land held by the defenders. "We swear, to our last drop of blood, to our last breath, to our last heartbeat, that we shall defend Stalingrad and hold the enemy back from the Volga. We swear that we shall not disgrace the glory of Russian arms, and we shall fight to the end." By now, the gramophone was king at Stalingrad. The most sought-after item in most Volga villages was a gramophone needle. These were priceless. They had to be sharpened especially carefully. Communal singing brought the Red Army back to life, and even the Germans, whose lines were only a few hundred meters away, became curious. "If you had a gramophone and a record of our favorite song, Katyusha, you might evade the enemy bombardment for a while," Mareshko told journalists later. Sometimes there were brief breaks in the fighting. On one occasion, the Germans, instead of shouting out the usual threat to drown Russians in the Volga, yelled something different. "Rus, play Katyusha!" As Mareshko said, it was hard to take this musical request seriously. But one Red Army soldier put the record on nonetheless. And many of our guys sang along to it. The shooting completely died down, and the Germans just listened. Then, when the music was over, the bedlam started again. At Sergeant Pavlov's house in a square 300 yards from the Volga, the fighting lasted almost 2 months. The Germans had used blunt force methods against him over and over, and were unable to dislodge this man and his platoon from the 42nd Guards Regiment. They were being helped by about a dozen civilians, who were caught in the four-story basement when the fighting began and could not leave. One was a woman by the name of Maria Ulyanova, who fought alongside the men of the platoon. Pavlov had smashed holes in the walls, making better firing points for their machine guns and long-barreled anti-tank rifles. When the panzers arrived to take on the platoon, Pavlov knew the only way to survive was to head to the cellar and the top floor. The panzers were too close for their guns to elevate high enough and then became sitting ducks for Pavlov's accurate fire. After 58 days of fighting, Choikov pointed out that Pavlov's small platoon had killed more enemy soldiers than the Germans lost taking Paris. Another hero of the battle was also getting busier. I've mentioned sniper Vasily Zaitsev. Unfortunately, there's also a myth that has developed around his supposed sniper duel with the German flown to Stalingrad, especially to kill Zaitsev. The only problem was this never happened. However, Zaitsev was being sought by the Germans after propaganda reports that the crack sniper had been responsible for the deaths of almost 100 Germans by late October 1942. Out in the steppe, south and west of Stalingrad, the routines of the German divisions was very different to what was going on inside the city. These Germans occupied defense lines and forayed into no man's land, trying to capture Russians, but life was far easier. Take Sunday the 25th of October, for example, where the officers of the Bavarian 376th Infantry Division sent a formal invitation to their divisional commander, General Edler von Daniels, inviting him to a Munich Oktoberfest shooting contest, right there on the steppe. Men in this region were preparing now for another winter. They were building bunkers in the sides of mounds or planning how to keep themselves warm. And way to the east, over the Volga, far out of sight, the Russians were slowly but surely building a massive army which was going to arrive in the so-called quiet zone to completely change the situation for Army Group South. More about that in coming episodes. Right now, we're calling a halt. Please rate the podcast on iTunes if you have time. You can also contact me through my website, abwarpodcast.com, or direct message me on Twitter, @DesLatham. Until next week, goodbye.